So today we've come to the outskirts of Arras, a place called Barains, and we've come to the Commonwealth War Graves Commission Visitor Centre, which was open, when was it open?
2019,
just before COVID, wasn't it? And we're going to be given a guided tour today by Lucy, who is the, was it communications officer, did I say? Please introduce yourself, Lucy. Tell us who you are.
Well, hello, I'm Lucy, and I'm a communications officer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission in France. And I've been working for the commission ever since the centre opened in June 2019.
How many visitors have you had since then? Obviously, we had COVID.
I remember the numbers for last year, which was around 7,000.
7,000 people have been through the doors.
Yeah, just for 2023. So I think in total, maybe close to 20,000.
That's a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's quiet at the moment, isn't it? It's only us here at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, it's only the beginning of the season. So we're expecting coaches next week.
Coaches start, you said, next week.
Yes,
yes. So what are we going to find here when we go through? There's a big, what colour's that? Mustardy, mustard door leading to all sorts of things behind there. And you're going to take us through there. What sort of things are we going to see today?
Well, the idea is really to let people see how the Commonwealth War Graves Commission works to maintain the different sites around the world. So you're going to see the different workshops where the craftsmen work, and in particular, you're going to see where all the headstones are engraved, because that's what's special about this site. It's that all the headstones for all our sites are engraved here in France.
All over the world.
Yes.
So even if they're in Africa.
Exactly, yeah.
And we've got some numbers on the wall behind us, some key numbers. Talk us through those.
So these are sort of the key numbers that help you have an insight as to our organisation. So you've got, on the left, you've got the only one and unique headstone production unit.
It's here,
exactly, that you'll see in a minute.
Yep.
Then you have 994 football pitches, so that's the equivalent of the ground area that we maintain. So that's what the gardeners are looking after every day all around the world.
That's a lot of football pitches.
That's a lot of football. Thankfully, we don't do football games in those sites, but that's just to give you an idea, really.
Yeah.
And speaking of gardeners, we have 850 gardeners around the world.
And they work in teams?
Yes, they do. They work in groups and in what we call base sites.
Yeah.
And from those base sites, you're going to have a team of gardeners that looks after the cemeteries of that area.
They might have four or five cemeteries that they look after.
Sometimes even more. We have a base site in Lens, where you've got 10 gardeners. They look after 40 sites.
Yeah,
that's a lot in the area. That's quite a lot. Yes, we have just in France we have around 3,000 sites.
Yeah,
and in the whole world, which is what you see here, we have 23,000 locations
all around the world.
So that's cemeteries and memorials around the world in 153 countries and territories. Yes,
150, and then we get really serious numbers when we see 1.1 million.
Yeah,
that's the amount of headstones, but that's not the amount of commemorations, though, is it?
No. It's we commemorate 1.7 million people around the world. So that's you've got the missing, and you've got the people who have been identified. So 1.1 million, that's the number of people we have buried in our
headstone
sites.
For them,
Not all of them are identified, because some of them were buried as unknown soldiers. And then you have 600,000 names on memorials all around the world.
So they're definitely on the memorials, and they may have a grave beneath a missing name.
Exactly.
Or they may be nowhere. They may have been blown to pieces, or their grave later lost.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. Shall we go through to our first?
Let's go. Through the mustard door.
The mustard door opens, and we walk into a big room with a video on the wall. And this looks like Lego to me.
It is.
Do you have Lego in France?
It is. So that's a Lego model that was made by two people in Belgium.
Oh, right.
And this represents a site in Belgium.
So it's an actual site, is it?
It is. It is, actually. And some of the pieces were actually custom made.
Really?
Just for that model, yeah.
Wow, that's fantastic.
The people who did that are also responsible for having done a huge Meningate Lego replica.
Really?
That we usually display in our information centre in Ypres.
Yeah.
So.
Yes, I have seen that now.
Yes. So that's the same people.
Yeah, I remember seeing that now. Yeah. It's the same people. And then on the wall, We've got those famous words of Rudyard Kipling, the biggest single bit of work since the Pharaohs, and they worked in their own country. The difference is that the commission is working all over the world, isn't it?
Yeah, it was really quite the undertaking at the time, and it's something that it's difficult to imagine now what the undertaking was at the time, really, like all around the world, all the people that had to be commemorated. It's really the amount of deaths and victims and dead.
So it's one thing finding graves for the identified dead and for the missing, but what were they going to do to remember the missing? I think this was the biggest challenge, wasn't it, that they faced at the time. And the result of that is the memorials at Teat Vale and the Menningate and so on.
Yeah.
And then up here we've got images of the key people from the Commonwealth. So what was then the Imperial War Graves Commission? Who are these? I recognise some of these faces.
So these are really, we call them the founding fathers of the commission. And especially you've got the man who had the idea of creating our organisation, who's right here, that's Sir Fabian Weir.
Yeah. He's the founding father, really, isn't he?
Yes, yes. So to give him a bit of a background, he was in France during the First World War, not as a fighting not as a soldier, but he was a volunteer in the British Red Cross.
He was too old to fight.
Exactly. He was already 45, so he was deemed too old to enlist in the fighting corps. But because he still wanted to do his part, he got involved with the British Red Cross, and he was tasked with the mission to coordinate the transport of the wounded from the battlefields to the hospitals and casualty stations. Yeah. And when he was in the area around Béthune, he spent a bit of time in the cemeteries that were starting to emerge because of those casualty clearing stations. So we were in September 1914, and the cemeteries were already in a very, very bad shape because people just didn't have the time and the means to really properly make burials. You had wooden crosses, but the names were already fading. And worse than that, because people didn't have time, there wasn't any registers where you had the names of the soldiers buried there. And that was a huge problem, because as soon as the station would move with the troops, you'd just completely forget the places.
He started recording all these details.
Exactly.
Then, didn't
he talked to his relations in the army. He knew a lot of people in very high places. And thankfully, some of them had shared his opinion that something had to be done to take care of the soldiers who travelled so far to come and fight in countries where that they'd never seen before. Mm-hmm. So in 1915, he was given a unit that was called the Graves Registration Unit. And the mission at the time was to go everywhere on the Western Front to try and record all the places where you had burials and where the soldiers had fallen, so that after the war, something could be done to properly commemorate those men.
Which we'd never done before.
No, that was really the first time. And because this was, the First World War was very different in terms of the last conflicts, in the sense that people were really starting to have, you know, the need of having an individual commemoration, where before in the last big conflicts, you had usually the soldiers were buried in mass graves and
didn't record anything. Did
no, they didn't, and you suddenly had that aspect of wait, hang on, we want to know what's going on with our sons, with our fathers, with our brothers. We want to know where they fell. We want to pay our respects to them.
We've got a civilian army that we're recruiting now, aren't we? We're starting to recruit Kitchener's army.
Exactly, yeah.
They knew that if we were going to give up our menfolk, that people want to know what happened to them.
Yeah. At the time, the reason that, well, something that fueled Kipling's efforts was the fact that at the time in 1914, people heard back home that it was just, unfortunately, it was a slaughter in France and Belgium. And a lot of the families were already asking, what are you doing with our dead? What are you doing with our dead? Mm. And so that's something that helped Fabian Weir with his efforts to get this on foot, to really say to the families, this is what we're doing to find their graves. And this is what we will do in the future to commemorate them properly.
Yeah, great.
And the very first name of the commission after the Graves Registration Unit was actually the Directorate of the Registration of Graves and Inquiries. So really, during the war, we were already answering families because they were already asking, where is he?
Yeah, what's happening?
Yeah.
And then we've got some other key people here. I can see Lutyens up there. We've got Kipling, haven't we, as well there?
Yeah.
There's Kenyon. Kenyon's up there. Which one's Kenyon?
Over there, on
there's
the right.
Kenyon. What was his role?
So Kenyon joined a bit later on because the commission itself was founded not in 1915, but 2 years later, officially founded 1917. And that's really at that time that Fabian Weir gathered a first committee around him.
Yeah.
And he asked Sir Ferry Kenyon, to participate because Kenyon had a very interesting background. He was the director of the British Museum. And so he was used to handling different cultures, and he was a philanthropist at heart. So he really had the human being in mind. And when he came over, he studied the different aspects of the commission. He went to France, he went to Belgium.
Whilst the war's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he created the first report of our organization in 1918. And it actually bears his name. It's the Kenyon Report.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And it sets out the fundamental principles then, doesn't it, of the what was then still the Imperial War Graves Commission. And there's three main principles, yeah, is that right?
Actually, four.
There's four.
But there's one that is very closely linked to another one, so that's why we always sort of, you know, tend to forget it. So the first one is that we commemorate everyone by name.
Yeah.
So either on a headstone, if we've identified the remains of the victim, or on a memorial to the missing, if we have not found the remains. Mm-hmm. The second principle is that they're all commemorated equally, regardless of rank, faith.
No distinction in civil life. There may be, you know, a mayor or a politician, and they can be next to a private soldier who's a minor.
Exactly. That it's not taken into account for us. Everyone's on the same page. The third principle, which is the one that
controversial one.
It's a controversial one, and it's the one that is often forgotten because it's linked to the equality principle. Is the fact that all headstones had to be uniform.
Yeah.
So that meant no Christian crosses as a shape for the headstones.
That really upset a lot of Christians because Britain at that time was heavily Christian.
Yeah.
But we still had to take into account the Commonwealth, which included people of other religion and no religion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There was a petition that gathered 1,000 signatures, and we actually had to defend our choice in front of the British Parliament. So at the time, the commission had the support of Winston Churchill. That helped us defend that choice. And the last principle was the fact that all cemeteries and memorials had to be permanent and cared for in perpetuity, which is why we're still here today, actually.
Yeah. And that work will continue forevermore, as we say, don't we?
Exactly.
With the commission.
Yeah. Yes.
Fantastic. So some key people there. Mm-hmm. Where do we go next then?
So we're going to go and see the workshops. So the first one on the list is the Headstone Production Unit.
Yep, headstones.
So let's go.
Headstones then. We're going to go and see how the headstones are made. You can always come back to get some pictures afterwards if we're going too fast.
No, it's all good. It's fantastic. It's so interesting.
It's so interesting.
I think this is the first time that I've been in this courtyard when it's not been raining. It has been raining today, hasn't it?
We've had good weather this past few days, but thankfully, when we opened the centre, we were like, okay, yes, there is going to be rain quite often.
Yes.
So we've had...
You've got a cover, haven't you?
Yes, we've got covers in front of the workshops. So if you come and visit the centre, you will not be in the rain if you look at the workshops.
But we are outside. The first room we went in was indoors, but we're now in a courtyard. And we're looking through enormous windows into workshops where all sorts of different work is going on. But the first one is the real key one that most people will be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that strikes me in this workshop, for a start, Michael, there's lots of tools in there that me and you wouldn't be familiar with.
No idea.
And secondly, what always gets me is the size of the headstones, because they're much bigger than what they appear when you see them in the cemeteries.
Yeah.
Why is that then?
It's because part of the headstone is into the ground in a cement beam to keep it upright.
Yeah.
And so you have around, if you actually look behind you, we've got a headstone and you've got the a line that tells you where the ground would appear.
Ground level is, yeah.
Yeah, it's
so about a quarter of it, like you said, has got to be sunk into the ground to keep it permanent, to keep it vertical. But still, sometimes they get damaged, don't they? And they
yes.
break off. What happens then? Are they replaced?
So when we can't repair them, we try to really repair and make them last as long as possible.
Yeah.
Not only for reasons that involve. The availability of stone,
yeah.
but also because they're part of our heritage
yes.
now. So you've got headstones that have been installed. Exactly. They've been there 100 years now. So we try to really have them as long as we can.
Yeah.
But when really we can't do anything anymore, we have a new headstone made
here. Going on in this enormous workshop, really.
Yeah.
But, originally these were all, we've seen photos of them being made by hand with a chisel and a hammer.
Yes.
But I don't see chisels and hammers in it. I see computers and machines.
So there was an extra step between the chisels and the computering machines, thankfully.
Yeah.
What happened was that in the 1920s, because there was a lot of headstones needed at the time,
yeah.
The commission actually called upon the different companies in the UK to find a solution so that we could produce headstones in large quantities.
Right.
And it was a firm in Lancashire that developed a machine that you have right there, actually,
yeah.
in this workshop.
Yeah.
That is called a pantograph.
Do you know how that works, Michael?
No idea.
So actually, if you, it'll pop up on the TV screen at some point. So we still use the pantograph today.
Yeah.
But at the time, it allowed for 4,000 headstones to be made a week.
Really?
In the 1920s.
Which is what they needed, didn't they?
Exactly.
To replace all the wooden crosses.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And so this machine, the person who's responsible for the workshops actually worked on that machine because we used it up until the 1990s.
Oh, right.
And at that time, in the 1990s, we received those Italian machines that you have now in the workshops.
Yeah.
So they're managed with computers.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got the files that are made in head office, so in Maidenhead.
Yeah.
We receive those files. We've got the person in charge of the workshop who calibrates the machine, so you've got a scanning process of the headstone, and then you've got the engraving that starts. And sometimes, if you have a headstone that is at the end of a row, where you have to engrave the number of the plots, because you can't put the headstone on the side on the new machines, you're going to
still
use
the old one.
And that's what you see right now on the TV. That's how it's used.
So it's not just a museum exhibit, it's still a working
machine.
It's
still a working place, and that's what's interesting about
the skill
the
level.
Center.
There's still a lot of skill going into this,
yeah.
isn't there?
And
he's dusting it down with his
literally.
Brush.
Yeah, it's very standard. Even just the headstones themselves, the thickness of them, the size of them, it's very standardized. It's really to the millimeter.
Mm.
So it has
so
to be very
same.
Precise.
Mm.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what you see. That's the part that goes in the ground.
You can see how far it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about a quarter of it goes into
yeah.
the ground.
Yeah,
then,
it does. Yeah, yeah.
And cemented in, as you say. Yeah.
So today we have around 1,500 headstones produced a year.
Right.
In the workshops.
Yeah.
So most of them to replace the broken or damaged headstones, but also to mark new burials and new identifications.
Yes, and we've got a big one coming to talk about. At Lewes, haven't we?
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, lots of new headstones needed for that. I don't suppose work has started on that yet, has it?
Not for the
headstones. But the work, the horticultural work is well advanced, isn't it?
Lewes British Cemetery Extension is quite an interesting project because we know that we're not going to have all the casualties buried at the same time.
Mm.
This
is because they're finding them with the canal project.
Yes. The canal or even any other
building
places
works.
Yes, where we could find new casualties. The idea is to, when we build that place, was to have a very large place where we could have all new discoveries
rather
buried
than
there.
Adding into existing cemeteries.
Exactly, because because our sites are really we're at maximum capacity, and we're at the point where when we do discoveries, we have more and more large discoveries. Mm. It's not just one soldier.
Multiple.
It can be 10, it can be 50.
Yeah,
so
you can't just slot them in, can you? Somewhere.
Exactly.
You need a new burial ground. It's going to be beautiful, isn't it?
That
location.
Yeah, it's the way we've decided to do it is that while the plots won't have new burials, they will be planted with wildflowers, and they will be left to grow in a sort of meadow state. To encourage biodiversity and sustainability. So it's going to be something very new.
Like a garden, isn't it?
Yes, it's going to be very different, very peaceful as well.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah.
And when does the commission think that the first burials will start to arrive there?
So if all goes according to plan, it should be next September.
Next year, it'll be official opening and a big ceremony.
Oh, this September.
Oh, September 24, isn't it?
Yes.
I keep thinking,
If all goes to plan, so fingers crossed, it's not official yet. It might be moved to 2025 for the anniversary of the Battle of Loos.
Battle of Loos, of course. Yeah.
But the idea is to have... to have the inauguration at the same time as burials, so that we can really formally inaugurate that extension.
And they are expecting quite a number of bodies to be located and found.
Well, they know there's so many still missing from those battles.
Yeah.
And because of the scope of the works, there could be a large number
identified. Yeah.
Hundreds.
In this workshop, we've got a lot of wood going on.
Yes, this is a carpentry workshop. So it's a bit different to the previous workshop because here we only maintain the French sites.
Right.
And it's always a bit surprising to visitors when they come here because they're like, why do you have a carpentry workshop?
Yeah.
Because
that's the obvious question, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. It's the pieces that you don't pay attention to at first when you enter a site. But you do have wooden furniture. We've got doors.
Benches.
To the gardener's shacks that you've got in our sites. Benches.
Yeah.
Windows to some of the... chapel-like
buildings. I think the thing is, when you come here and see this, you then go into the cemeteries
and you look at them, exactly.
Which is
what we want, really, to draw attention to all the features that are very delicate and require so much attention, especially wood, because of, the weather we have.
It's terrible, isn't it, this winter?
It can attack the wood and really make it rot quite quickly.
It swells up, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Wood swells up when it's wet.
So here, again, we try to renovate rather than replace. And that can be helped because the way the pieces are done is that they're assembled with traditional methods, so you don't have any screws or glue. It's all been made with tenon and mortise, wooden joints. So you can take them apart, you replace just the part that's damaged, and then you put it back together, send the piece, revarnish it, and that's it. It's good to go again for another 50 years.
Yeah, long as that.
But when we can't renovate, we replace, but we replace like for like. Yeah. We go and take the original schematics, and we do a perfect replica.
Yeah. So what people will see now will be exactly the same as what people saw 80, 90 years ago.
Exactly. Yeah.
Isn't it?
And what's interesting for the carpenters is that every feature is unique. You're going to have one tiny difference in design, or you're going to have a difference in size.
And this is the way the architects designed them, isn't it? That was the intention, that everything would be slightly different. No one cemetery is the same.
They look the same, and you have some principles that apply to all the cemeteries, but each cemetery is unique.
Yes.
And that's interesting.
That's the word. It's the uniqueness, isn't it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fascinating.
And the carpenters, they really manage the work from A to Z. They are the ones to go and put it back in place.
Do they? They
in
take
the
their work then to the cemetery.
Yes.
So they see it from cradle to grave, literally.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, this here is going to go to Normandy, Rees War Cemetery.
Yep.
So sometimes they go for a week to go and check, okay, all the cemetery sites in Normandy, okay, what needs to be done? And they maintain, we've got pergolas in some of our sites, and those are made of wood in Normandy, so they have quite
It's all got to be ready for June the 6th, isn't it, this year?
Yes, quite a lot of work.
Yeah, so that's number two. We've got a big number three on the wall now.
Yeah, and that's the mechanics.
Mechanics. Hear that, Michael? Mechanics.
The places where you won't recognise the tools.
Actually, we would. That's the one thing we can do. We can use my lords, don't we?
those are easy. Those we can recognise.
Yeah.
This place here maintains all the machines for France.
Yeah.
That represents around 1,400 machines for horticulture.
Yeah.
And we have, just for the lawn mowers, actually, we have around 80 types of different lawn mowers.
Yeah, different shapes and sizes.
Yes, because you've got sites that are so different. You have sites where it's a crater, some with large alleys, some with narrow alleys.
You've got to get between the stones.
Mm.
And, and some of the models, especially for the edge cutters, some of the machines have been made just for us. Mm. We work with the contractors. We tell them, okay, this is what we need. These are all standards. Mm. And they work with us, okay, this machine will suit your needs.
Yeah, for that particular cemetery.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting.
Dan could work here.
You could.
That's the only bit that we've got so far, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah.
The lawn mowers.
Get one out and go and do a bit of work.
Free labour.
Yeah.
But that's Thiebwald is an interesting
example. It is, because he's on a tractor
example.
There, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's got a ride on.
And actually, what we're developing at the moment is we're trying something new. We're trying robot lawnmowers.
Oh, we see these in England on sports grounds.
Yes. So the problem was we tried them a few years ago, but it was still the machines that, you know, sort of went one way, then another, then another. And so it wasn't very clean cut.
Okay.
But now they can calibrate them to have them go in a straight line.
Yeah.
And so we're having a test done in some of our sites in France. And if it's successful, it could help the gardeners focus, for example, on the borders during the time when the machine is just
cutting
along. And
helps with manpower as well, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah,
right.
Because like everybody else, I know the commission has struggled to find enough skilled people to do this, haven't they, over the years. You know, every industry is struggling to find skilled people, aren't they, all over Europe.
Yes, and the problem that we are facing, especially in France, is that a large part of our manpower is nearing their age of retirement.
Okay. Yeah.
And so we want to recruit people before they go into retirement because we want them to transmit their skills to the new generations.
Yeah, otherwise it's lost.
Yes.
I remember meeting a guy last year in the Fromelles area. I think you were with me, weren't you? And he was a young lad. And he'd been teaching English. He spoke perfect English like you.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd given up teaching
to become a gardener.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he was amazing, wasn't he?
Really
so passionate.
Guy, yeah.
Yes, it's when you work as a gardener for the commission, it's usually a vocation, really.
Yeah.
It's not just any place that you are gardening. It's cemeteries and it's memorials. And so, you do have people who are just turning their lives around and like, no, I want to do this.
Yeah,
I want to look after them.
So lost the teaching profession, I know that.
Yeah. If you want to know, I was actually a teacher for some time myself.
You were?
Yes.
Blimey. Actually, I can imagine you being a teacher. Sit down.
I was a mix of kind and stern.
Yeah.
Wow.
Depending on the students.
You're
teaching us now, aren't you?
I am. Yeah, it's still developing. Like it's coming from that. So.
Yeah. Those skills are still being used in a different environment.
They're not gone.
Wow, some stuff going on in here. Look at this, Michael.
So that's a window where you've got an evolution of the tools.
This is like a museum.
You can see
the old rollers.
Yeah, the old ones and the new ones on the right. And you can see a very old lawn mower that we used.
I can remember my dad using one of them.
Exactly,
in the 60s.
Yeah. So that is very sustainable. Like there's no motor, there's no oil.
No,
it's just really the strength of your arms.
Yes.
Yeah.
They were hard work, they were.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, my granddad.
Yeah, we had one of them too.
And the roller over there still got on it, the IWGC. So that's going back before.
Even if you look at the hammer, you can see IWGC engraved on the handle.
Yeah. I like the look of that hammer.
Yeah, it's destroyed.
That you can recognise, right?
Yeah.
I know what that is. That's right.
There's a vicious looking saw over there, isn't there? A two-man saw, look, with the handle at each end.
Thankfully, they don't use that kind of tools anymore.
Look at the teeth on that.
We actually have in France what we call a tree team.
Okay. Tree team.
Yes, we've got the tree team. You've got two people in France who are...
They don't live in the trees.
They could. they're agile enough that they could live in the trees.
Yeah.
But they go from site to site, and when branches need trimming or when you need... Up they go.
Yeah, it's a specialist skill, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's quite impressive when you go and see them look. And sometimes they go very high. Yeah. Like,
have you had a go at that yourself?
I haven't, no, because I'm not as agile as them, really.
Stick to the education.
Brilliant, right. Yes. I like to tell people about them, but I wouldn't do it myself.
No, I know what you mean. And now we're going into a really somber area, aren't we? The recovery and reburial. Very dark, somber room that I've now entered with a number of displays around me describing... the recovery and identification process. Lots of information here, lots of exhibits, personal stuff, isn't there? Like a soldier's boot that's there, and you realise that at some stage a man had his foot in that, and a British Tommy Brodie helmet there that's been badly damaged by shrapnel, and you wonder what happened to that man. And then there's the coffin. And another example of one of the headstones and the different flags from the Commonwealth neatly folded. But behind a grey door, a single grey door, it says behind this door is our anthropology laboratory. Due to the sensitivity of this work, it's not open to the public. Is that effectively the mortuary then?
It is, yes. Yeah. It really is the lab that you have behind that door. So it's really the place where we bring... the remains that we find on discoveries and the artifacts. So it's all happening here. Mm. And that's where the anthropologists do the report on what they found.
Yeah. And so if someone's out walking the fields or a farmer phones up and says, I think I found a body, the first thing they do is call the police, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And from then on, when the police arrives, if they see military items, they know to call us.
Right. Because they know it's not a recent murder, not a homicide. Mm-hmm. No one's bumped off their wife in recent times. They know that it's...
It did happen, though,
a few times
the police called us and we arrived and we're like, no, that's not for us.
Really? Okay. Someone's tried to disguise it to get away with the murder.
Yeah. It did happen.
That's a story for another podcast. So the commission will go along, carefully exhume the body, and then they'll bring it here. And then this long process begins then, doesn't it?
Yes.
Trying to identify. So it can go on for years?
It can. It really depends on the government... of where the soldier comes from.
What records they've got.
Yes, it's what happens is that when we go and intervene on site, first of all, the commission was very lucky to have this recovery unit, and for years we were the only ones having a recovery unit to intervene when the remains were found. Yes. Mm. And so that was the work of two people, Paul Bird and Steve Arnold, who are working in horticultural department. Uh-huh. So they really pulled this unit together, and they worked so well that they got called so often, and we had so many recoveries to do that they were joined a few years ago by anthropologists, and they put in place specific protocols to ensure that they had the best chances to identify
who it is.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So today, when we intervene, we go on site, we take pictures of the scene, because it's important to see any clues, like where the items are in regards to the body, how is the body lying, is it like, is he lying as if he was laid down, has he just fallen, was he thrown somewhere, so that is really something we need to find out, and that's why we take pictures.
You've only got one chance to do that.
Yes.
Like at a crime scene.
Yeah, and once we have done those pictures, we are very quick and efficient. We take the remains, we take the artifacts, and then we go.
You can't leave them there overnight, because someone will come along and take the body away, won't they, if they hear about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also a matter of the quicker you are to intervene and to get everything out, the more you're likely to get called again if you have another discovery on that same site.
Yeah.
And like you were saying, it's also important to to get it all out quick, because word travels really fast. And if it gets known that, oh, there was someone found here, you do have people come with detectors and try and salvage what they can.
And sell it.
And the problem with that is that the less artifact we have found with the bodies, the less chance we have at identification.
And they would damage the body as well, wouldn't they?
Also, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, we know that's happened in some places. And yeah, I remember people telling us about that. So then having established an identity, they then contact the relatives, don't they, for reburial?
It's, yeah, the so to put things back in context, the commission is in charge of doing the reports of what we have found. Then we contact our commemoration department in head office, and they're going to check in Maidenhead, and they're going to check the relevance of the information we found. So for example, if we found a regiment badge, has that regiment been through that area? So is it a good lead, or is it a misidentification? It can be a false lead, because soldiers did like to gather bits and bobs
as
well.
Yeah, they took souvenirs, didn't they?
Exactly.
Yeah. And
so once that case that has been built up, we contact the different governments. We contact Canada, we contact the MOD in the UK, in Australia, and we give them the case. We don't have the authority to say, okay, we think it's that soldier. It's really not up to us. So from then on, they take up the investigation. And as you said, sometimes it can take years. We had a Canadian soldier who stayed here for 11 years because the Canadians, they don't want to close an investigation until a name
has been
found.
They wouldn't give up, would they? They just won't give up.
They wouldn't. 11 years, yes. Sometimes, thankfully, it takes less longer.
But they found him? That one that took 11 years, they found him?
They did.
That's great.
They did find him.
Yeah. That's incredible, isn't it? Amazing. So how many, do you know how many would be here at the moment then awaiting identification?
Not for sure, because I do know that there was a lot of soldiers awaiting burials during COVID.
Because
it's always a military ceremony.
Yeah, we see the pictures of it on the wall.
So you always have a military regiment coming over.
From their own country.
Yes, and if we have identified the regiment, we try to have the same regiment.
Yeah.
And they always publicise, these commission always publicise these reburials, don't they, and rededications on the website and on social media. And people can, if they're in the area, can come along and watch it, can't they?
Oh, you can absolutely attend them. It's
a very special moment, isn't it?
It is, especially when you have relatives who have travelled over. And it gets very emotional, because some of them, it's like they lost someone last year, and they're recovering a piece of their history.
Because they've probably heard that story from their parents and their grandparents. Their parents and their grandparents have gone to their own graves without knowing what happened, and suddenly you're doing that for them on their behalf, and it's as though they're there with them.
Yeah, on behalf of that family line.
So this is it feels in here much colder than it does outside in this room.
Also because there's no heating on
in
this room. But that's also because we have the lab next to it.
Yes.
So we can't have heating on in this room, because you need to have very specific conditions in the lab.
Yes.
So that's why. Yeah. And it also sets up the atmosphere.
It does, very much so. As soon as it came through that door, you could feel it. It's darker in here.
Yeah.
It felt darker when we came in.
Yeah.
And the exhibits, you know, we've got combs and razors on the wall, and this boot. That's one of yours, it's an Australian, isn't it? Yeah. As we said, when we wandered around Northampton, where I come from, so many of the boots came from Northampton. You know, we supplied them to all of the allied nations, so probably not Australian, but so many of these lads' boots would have come from my hometown.
But that's interesting, because it's something we look for when we have when we find items. It's sometimes you're going to have the mark of the of the firm who made it.
Yeah.
And so you can say, oh, it came from that place. Oh, so the soldier must be from that nationality.
Locality,
or at least it's a lead. It could
be. It's a possible lead, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
And there's a video on the wall, which we're just looking at now, showing the process of how a reburial and the horticultural work is being done by hand with care and love.
It's the gardeners. That's also why they're very involved and committed to their jobs. The gardeners are the ones who finalise the burials.
It's the final process.
Yes. Yeah. As soon as the ceremony is over,
yeah.
they are here to install the turf, to install the headstone, to install the border. And they have to be quick and efficient, because if the families are here,
yes.
we want them to see.
To come back and see it the yes. next day, perhaps. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, it's a very, very special room. Mm-hmm. And there's a small wooden coffin over there.
Yes, that's the former coffins that would have been used at the time. Now, no matter the amount of remains that we find, it's always a full-size
yeah.
coffin.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And some of the countries, like Canada, they actually send us the coffins that they want to they want to use. And the Canada, they always have it's maple.
I was gonna say maple.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Of course, the original burials in places like Sayre Road No. 2 and Tynecott, they wouldn't have had coffins at all, would they? It's just sewn up in sacks. Yeah.
It's for the battlefield cemeteries. Yes, sometimes people ask us, is there a coffin? It's the truth is we don't know. Sometimes, yes, they were just laid to the ground and the headstone wasn't all later on. It's really, as much as possible, we tried not to disrupt the burials that were already existent.
Mm.
Because it wouldn't have felt right to just dig them up, put them in a box, and put them back down
again. Disturbing them, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. They're at peace. They're at rest.
Exactly.
Now, and they have been for all those years. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. There's an extract from the Kenyan report on the wall just as we leave this dark room. It says all, whatever their military rank or position in civil life, should have equal treatment in their graves. And that's the case in 90%. I think we saw one yesterday in Bethune where there was a small plot and there was a row and they were all officers, but they were from 1914. That predates, therefore, the requirement for equality, doesn't it? And Lichtenhoek's the same. There's a whole row there with officers.
Yes.
Again, they predate when they had Kenyon came in with that principle. There's always exceptions, aren't there?
Always.
So we leave this room. That's at Tynecott, isn't it? There's a Lancashire Fusilier, picture on the wall of the Lancashire Fusilier and two Australians from 2018, I think that was. I remember that story. Back out into the courtyard. Oh, blimey, there's a serious looking meeting going on in there. Less said about that, the better. there's always meetings.
It's an HR meeting.
it's HR, it's even worse. Only enough of that in corporate life. We'll move past that one.
It's sometimes that I have my colleagues saying to me that they're in a meeting and they're going to have visitors just look at them through the window with an audio guide and they don't quite know how to react.
No, just carry on regardless. Now we enter another room, which is fascinating because on the wall we've got examples of the green Commonwealth War Graves Commission signs that we see pointing the direction of the cemeteries that help us as we navigate our way around the battlefields. But here we've got, it's amazing, we've got examples of signs from all over the world, the Western Front and in Britain and in Germany and way beyond that, Kandy War Cemetery in Sri Lanka, isn't it? And then we look through the window and we've got some of the original old signs, real museum pieces, aren't they?
So those were made out of cast iron in the United Kingdom, and at the time we had a painter in here who could renovate them.
Ah, that's what you said. So you found them in an archive somewhere.
Yeah, it's actually those Hedgerow Trench. Hedgerow Trench is the cemetery you saw the Lego model in the room. Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah, they were changed. The signs.
Spoilbank Cemetery. Susan's great-grandfather was buried in Spoilbank.
Yeah. Wow. So that's what the sign would have been.
The original sign, would have been there when he was buried.
Pretty cool.
Unfortunately, they were all changed to aluminium for legislation reasons. But the lettering and the colouring of them has always been the same.
Yes, because we've seen the
innate on the wall.
On the wall, the replacement of the Spoilbank sign.
I noticed there, eyesight at my eye level there, the Gaza War Cemetery.
Yeah, yep. I just saw that.
And obviously there's Commonwealth War Graves Commission staff there. Do we know how they're getting on?
We know that the family who looks after the site has been able to get out safely.
They've got out.
Yes.
Right.
So that was a relief.
Yes,
that
definitely,
really was
yeah.
a relief.
And one day they'll return. And one day the cemetery will be looked after again, won't
yes,
it?
Yes, it's
playing the long game, isn't it?
It does happen that you have cemeteries and memorials in places where you've got tension. Mm-hmm. It happened during the Cold War.
Yeah.
It happened in Iraq
in yeah.
Afghanistan. So when there's any risk to our teams, we just
bring them out
if we can, because in that case, the Gerada family, they were living in the country, so they are not UK citizens, so you can't expatriate them, really.
Right.
But when we can, we tell them, no,
stay safe. They're local contractors, aren't they, in these countries? But obviously our main concern in Gaza at the moment isn't the war cemetery, it's the people living there.
No, it's,
it?
Yes. Yeah. That we will come back, as you say, it's really we'll come back in the long term, and really we will deal with that.
As they did, I'm seeing photographs of cemeteries in Iraq that had been destroyed in the war, and it was Iraqi contractors that went back and built them up again, and they look wonderful again, don't they?
Yes, it's in 2019 we sent 300 war headstones to Abaniya War Cemetery.
I was racking my brain, so I don't remember the name of the cemetery.
It was Abaniya, but there's also a lot of work to be done, and one of the TDs shows it. There's the Basra Memorial in Iraq.
It's just a memorial to the missing.
Yes, and it's got quite a peculiar story, because it was pretty much inside the city, and at the time Saddam Hussein decided he didn't like it there, and he didn't destroy it, thankfully, but he moved it to the desert, and he didn't tell the commission
really?
At the time.
So it's not a small object.
It's
move,
not
just
a small
like that.
One, though, but it's... so they were like, okay, where is it?
Would you mind telling us where you've moved it before we hang you?
And so because now it's in the desert, you've got a lot more sandstorms, so it gets damaged a bit more quickly.
Oh,
so there's going to be a lot of work on that as well.
Okay. Huh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
What an amazing story.
Yeah.
And again, you look at cemeteries like in Hong Kong, you look at photographs from 1947.
That's Basra,
isn't it? Yeah. In Hong Kong, you look at pictures from 1947. It looks down to the sea, the harbour there.
Mm.
And on either side of the cemetery, there are fields.
Yeah.
And now you look
at it,
there's all these high-rise buildings there, but still our cemetery is there.
It remains
it's permanent.
The same. It's something that's very interesting, because you're in front of a cemetery that hasn't changed. But you have to imagine the view that the architect had at the time.
Yes.
And so it's a different feel to it today.
It's within the city now, isn't
it?
And the other thing that I've seen on social media recently is people saying, oh, look at the condition of the cemeteries and the graves, they're brown. This is all to do with the weather that we've had, isn't it?
Yes.
In recent weeks.
And it's also because we have stopped using chemicals. For a lot of time, the headstones stayed gleaming white because we used a lot of chemicals, and unfortunately that damaged a lot of things, and we weren't the only ones doing it back then.
Yes.
But we've recognized that we can't do that anymore. So today we're approaching a really more sustainable stage, and it's really... We're trying to work with enzymes, for example, to try and slow down, for example, fungi that can develop in the stone. But unfortunately, when it's very, very wet and very damp, they are going to come out. And there's not a lot you can do, because if you intervene on the headstone, the next week, it'll be back. So you just need to wait drier weather, and they'll be in a much... better state when it gets
and they've been out. We've seen photographs again on social media of the commission going out and starting to wash them down with just water, really, isn't it?
Yes, it's very important. Sometimes people ask us, because they want to help, and we are very grateful that people want to help us maintaining those headstones. We only use clean water and a soft brush, and that's it. What our gardeners have.
Brush.
What the extra stuff they have is a is a steam machine, but it's a very, it's a low pressure steam because we don't want to damage the stone.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
People can get involved in this in the UK if they join as a volunteer with the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. There's a project called Eyes on Hands On. There are thousands of burial sites in the UK, some bigger than others, within churchyards, maybe just one headstone there. And people can sign up, they can look after. Eyes on means visiting that grave every few months, and hands on means if it needs cleaning, then that process they can be involved in as well, and they can sort of adopt that grave. So there is a way that they can help, but not when they're in on the continent. Leave that work to the commission's professional contractors, because they know what they're doing.
Yes.
Great. Some more examples. Ah, this is really important, isn't it? We've got four headstones here, and it says in yellow on the floor, there's a line 2 meters away, which is where I'm standing now, and it says you should be able to read a headstone from 2 meters away. Stand on the lines and see whether you think the second headstone from the left needs to be engraved. What do you think? Well, the one that says an airman.
It's getting near it. I mean, I've got my glasses on, so that helps.
I can still read it.
And also, we're inside.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're inside with a light, so the conditions are a bit different than if you were outside with, you know, brighter conditions. So if you were outside, this headstone wouldn't be up to our standards.
That would need to be re-inscribed, repaired, but not replaced, because
not
the structure's
replaced,
okay.
No. We try, if the state of the stone is still okay, what we're going to do is we're surfacing the headstone, and then we re-engrave.
Right.
Sometimes it's just part of it, sometimes it's the entire headstone.
Yeah.
So we have a team of re-engravers who travel through France, and they go from cemetery to cemetery, and they redo the inscriptions.
About 11,000 a year, it says on the wall, that are improved and re-engraved.
Yeah.
As that change of policy means that if they weren't doing that, that'd be 11,000 new headstones that would have to be created and using up, you know, minerals from the earth, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that's an important saving, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And also because we have been in the past in front of a problem where Portland stone just ran out, and so you're like, okay, what do we do? So in like the emergencies that we had at the time, I had a stone to Botticino marble, but that type of stone isn't suited to the weather we had here.
Looks nice when it first goes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The marble, smooth, but it doesn't last, does it?
No, it doesn't last.
It's
in here,
durable.
It doesn't last. In southern France, southern Europe, that is
warmer.
Fine. You've got
it's
warmer, you've got less damp, but in here, because of the damp, you've got cracks in the stone much quicker. So that's also a reason why we're really renovating rather than replacing. And as we said earlier, also because of the heritage aspect of
it. It's history, isn't it?
Yes.
And, you know, they expected these headstones to age in time. That was one of the things that they said at the time, wasn't it? You know, they themselves, the cemeteries and the headstones are part of history now, as much as the war.
Yeah. And they belong to the soldier that is there.
Mm. Oh, got still got a number 9 outside, I can see.
Yes, it's the last workshop.
Yeah. Back out into the courtyard.
Yeah.
And we look through a window. Oh, blimey, I can see vices and all sorts of things in here, Michael. Good gracious, look at all this. This brings back horrible memories from school, this does.
Oh, did you practice blacksmithing in school?
No.
No?
I was asked to leave the room, I think. The evening practical came along and don't darken our doorstep again, I think is what the teacher said. What's going on in this room then? We've got lots of metal on show.
So this is the forge. That's where we maintain all the iron, bronze and steel elements. It's very traditional. You don't have a lot of modern tools. You actually have a forge at the back of the workshop where the blacksmiths can shape metal into specific shapes, or they can also create tools for the stone masons and the engravers, very specific tools adapted and suited to their needs. But here what we do, 90% of what we do is renovation, because the advantage of iron doors compared to wooden doors is that it's going to last a lot longer. We also renovate the registry boxes.
Made of bronze.
It's part. It's bronze, and then you've got some metal in it as well. But we sand them, repolish them, and the register boxes actually, even if they all look alike, again they're all unique and specific to a certain site. You won't be able to have a register box installed in another cemetery. It just won't fit in. And something else, another work that the blacksmiths have been doing very recently in relation to the anthropologists is cleaning and renovating metal artifacts that are found with the remains.
Right. Of which you've got some examples here, haven't we?
Yes, you have a mix of items that have been really repolished and made anew, and some items that have just been cleaned where you can still see part of the rust. So that you can really see the process.
Well, quite a lot of times these things have got inscriptions on them, haven't they? The soldiers on razors and things like that have put their name and number on.
Yeah.
We've got an officer's whistle there. It looks like it was made yesterday.
It's it was quite impressive. Sometimes we have pocket watches. And there was one time where a blacksmith, Christian, renovated entirely the pocket watch, and it was given back to the family.
Really?
During the reburial.
And the soldier that died, who owned it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's so sweet. And this is where then they would have made the gates, replacement gates, for the Indian memorial at Neuve-Chapelle.
Went
there. They've been stolen, they've been sawn off.
Yeah.
When we went there yesterday, they looked brand new, and I said to you we're going to go and see where they were made, and this is where they would have been made, in here.
It is, yes. It was quite an exceptional piece, because as we were saying, it's 90% isn't creation of replicas. It's really renovation.
Whether it's been stolen, you've got no choice.
So that was really the choice of the Indian government of what to do, because
really?
It was their memorial.
Choice.
The original doors were made out of bronze. Which is also why they were stolen, unfortunately.
Yes, it's valuable, yeah.
And the new ones are made out of steel.
But they
were very... very imposing in the workshops.
Yeah, yeah.
And what you have here is very, also very unique. You actually have the gates that will be installed in Loos British Cemetery Extension.
So these are new.
These are new,
Double gates there.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary, because you don't create new iron features anymore, and so this is quite incredible.
So someone's had to design that from scratch.
Yes. So we tried to. It was the same challenge with Fromelles Pheasantwood Military Cemetery. You want to design new things, but you want them to look like the designs that would have been made in the 1920s.
Yes. Yeah, it's that culture, isn't it?
Yes.
We want to keep the same culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's the right word.
And which it does, doesn't it? When
you look at it, I think so.
Yeah.
And all the elements here, they're made there's no welding done on the elements. So it's what we call the half iron method of assembly. So just imagine two bars of metal. You have a U shape that is dug in the middle. You just slot them together.
Okay, interlock.
Yes.
Could do that.
And so that also means that they're not hollow.
No.
It's full, and so small
gates.
Like a
dovetailing. I remember you used to say dovetailing with wood. Yeah. They used to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what I'm on about. I don't know what I'm talking about.
See, you do know craftsmanship.
I just suddenly remembered.
But a small gate, it would be 100 kilograms.
Wow.
So if you're intervening on a site that is close to the road, and you can have the tools and you can bring the door just next to the entrance, that is perfect. But sometimes in the Somme, you have cemeteries down in the field, so you have to park
Regina
400
Trench.
Meters away. And
Regina
then
Trench is a good example of that.
Carry it all the way down,
Wow.
Which is why they've got the big beam.
That's for the workshops, especially when they were working. For example, we were talking about Neuve-Chapelle, when they were working on the doors, because they were so heavy, 200 kilograms each. They would have, if they were working on, you know, the downside of the door, they would have it raised with hear this crane.
Yeah, brilliant.
Huh. Amazing.
So you don't realise, do you? Until you come here, you don't realise how much work is involved, how much thinking is involved, planning is involved, skill that's involved, craftsmanship. And as we say, just as we come to the end of our tour now, that we think now when we head off, we're going to go off to Serre now and look at the cemeteries there. And straight away now, we'll be looking and thinking about what we see there, the features and how they've been created and all those years ago, and how that work is still continuing now. And it will continue forever more, won't it? You're going to be here for a while yet, aren't you?
Well, not forever, but yes, I will certainly be here for a while more, I hope.
Oh, I'm really grateful for showing us around today. It's been
fantastic.
Thank you for coming.
People can find the Vista Centre online.
Yes, we have a page on our website, which is the cwgc.org.
Yeah.
So you've got a page that describes all the details, all the practical information
about
the centre, visiting hours, access.
And it's Monday to Friday, isn't it?
Yes, 9 to 4. So we don't close during lunchtime.
No, you don't have a lunch break, do you?
No, I don't really.
You work too hard for that.
But thankfully, I do have a few padding left, so I'll be good.
And, you know, it's just drizzling now, but if you're staying on the Somme, you're only 20, half an hour on the Somme, on the edge of Arras, so it's easy to get to. If you're coming in a small group, then you don't have to make an appointment. If you come in with a coach, it's advisable to make an appointment, isn't it?
Yes, below 12 people, there's no need to book. You can just turn up and you can have an audio-guided tour. If you want a guided tour, it's better to reach us beforehand so we can have a guide ready for you.
Yeah.
But if you're coming with a group above 12 people, then yes, you reach out to us.
Yeah. Great.
Well worth doing.
Yeah.
Well worth doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So there you go. I hope you enjoyed the podcast that I recorded there with Lucy. It's extremely interesting. As usual, I learnt lots that I didn't know before, even though I've been to the visitor centre several times. Having a guided tour from someone as knowledgeable as Lucy really brings out that information. So I do hope that when you're on the battlefield, you take the time to go and see the exhibitions and the exhibits and the workshops that we've just been talking about for the last hour. But now I want to just talk about something else briefly before we end the podcast this week. I recently stayed as guests once again of Julie and David Thompson at number 56 Bed and Breakfast in Labwassel. And Julie and David also are trustees of the Lochnagar Crater Association, which looks after the crater that's just round the corner from their bed and breakfast accommodation. And I caught up with them and they gave me an update with what's going on with the repairing and replacement of the path that runs around the perimeter of this enormous crater that was fired beneath the German lines on the 1st of July 1916. And this is what Julie and David have got to say.
Yeah, anybody who's visited the crater and been following our progress, the pathway is in urgent need of being replaced. Progress so far, we've about 185 metres have been done, which is about half a way round. So from the cross going clockwise, we're sort of halfway round towards the other side. And at the part where, if anybody knows the area, what we call the George Nugent crosses, the cross that commemorates George Nugent, who was one of the soldiers who died at the crater and his remains were found there several years ago, or 20 odd years ago. So about 185 metres done, which means we've got about 185 to do. Our target, if we can, is to have it completed by the end of this year. And we rely totally on donations. Nobody's funding this. We had a generous donation from the Western Front Association, which helped get us complete the bit that we've done. And we've had some small grants from the Somme Battlefield Pipe Band have helped us. The Somme Museum in Albert has helped us with a small grant. And we've had a couple of small grants from the French state recognising the importance of this site. But everything else that we need more funds to help complete the path. But it's being done in 10-metre sections. We've got the very difficult bit to do at the moment, which is the steps that lead down to the George Nugent Cross. But that's the bit that we're working on at the moment with a proper builder who knows what he's doing. So if you're visiting the crater and you have got a chance to donate, there are QR codes that you can click and donate by PayPal, or if you can donate from the comfort of your own home, if you go to the Loch Na Garr website, which is lochnagarrcrater.org, and there is a support page there for you to donate online. And every penny helps make a difference, or every cent or centime, depending where you are in the world listening to this. David, have you got anything to add to that?
I've just finished my sandwich now. Yeah, very nice. Yeah, I think the other thing, people say, oh, it's taken a long time to do this. Though those who have been to the crater before remember, in various sections we had steps. Well, all the steps are being taken away now to allow disabled access, so that the plan will be no steps, gentle gradients to allow, you know, wheelchair access, etc., yeah, which is highly important, which is why, as Julie said, we received money from the French state, because we were committed to allowing access to the crater for all people, irrespective.
Which was the intention of Richard when he bought it all those years ago, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
To remember. And what I should have pointed out is that Julie and David not only run this fine establishment, but you are trustees of the Loch Na Crater Association.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah.
And people can join that, can't they? There's an annual fee to join that.
Again, we encourage people to join up. Again, through the website, there's a Join the Friends of Loch Na Garr, and we're a charity registered in the UK and also registered in France as an association. So we're properly set up, and people can join. We have a working weekend, which we have annually. We call it the working weekend, which is always the May late bank holiday in the UK, which is over the, I think this year it's, that's the 24th to 26th of May. And volunteers come over and we spend, it's very communal, very community-based, very sharing. It's a good social event as well, but we do all the work that needs to be done at the crater, such as cutting back the hedges, strimming inside the crater, which is a job in itself at the angles that the crater is at, looking after the cross and any kind of work to the benches that needs doing. So a general good maintenance. So that's the weekend of the 24th to 26th of May.
And people come over at their own costs, bring their own tools.
Absolutely. Yeah, come over. We have quite a lot of tools that we've accumulated over the years. So if you've come with a pair of gloves and a will to work, that's all you need. But if you want to bring your own tools, that's fine too. And it's a superb weekend. And it goes on no matter what the weather.
Yeah, the weather today is a bit grim, isn't it?
Yeah, but the other thing that we're doing, which will be finished off by that working weekend, is replacing the information panels at the crater. The posts have gone in, and then new information panels will be installed at that working weekend. So, because the crater is exposed to so much weather, whether that be intense sunshine, frost, rain, wind, the panels have weathered, the existing panels have weathered to the point that they were very difficult to read.
Well, so when you drive past it, you can see the lip, the 11-foot lip, can't you? And that makes it even more exposed than it was before, or before the ground was. And the other thing is that people can do, there's memorial plaques, aren't there, all the way around the crater, which are being added back to the new path as it goes in. And people can buy those in memory of veterans, not necessarily that died, that served anywhere on the Western Front or in the war.
Absolutely. So, a memorial to any kind of loved one, relative, or schools have donated for ex-pupils, that kind of thing. And people love to walk around the crater and stop and look at the plaques to see who's remembered there.
But it makes you think, doesn't it? It makes you think about them.
And it's, again, that's part of Richard Dunning's. He's always had the idea that the crater is everybody's. The crater is for everybody. It's for the soldiers who were there. It's for the soldiers who fought wherever in the Great War. And it's for us today, a place of peace, remembrance, reconciliation, and where we can come together, because with so much destruction in the world at the moment, it stands
even more important,
a beacon
of
peace, really. Yeah.
And here in Ladbrokesale, number 56, what's the news from here, David? You've been very busy so far this year.
Yes, it's been a very good year so far. Some extraordinary guests bringing their stories. Chats around the table, we all learn every day. Nobody knows it all.
It's going on now, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
You know, we're in the kitchen and we can hear people chatting away. They've finished their breakfast and they're still sitting there chatting.
Everybody swaps experiences and stories, and it's what we say is the magic of this place, really. It's not anything David and I do. It's what guests bring with an open mind and an open
You give
heart.
Us the opportunity to do that, I think. You're very lovely welcome that you give us all. And out there, you know, we've got people from all over the world out there, because we've got people from Holland, got people from Australia that have come, and obviously from the United Kingdom. International
Clients. Yeah, we had somebody Danish earlier in the week, so it's a real international community, absolutely.
And you've still got a few gaps in your diary if people want to come.
We have, absolutely. Always welcome. Anybody is always welcome. Thank
Marvellous.
You.
Well, we're going to venture out into the wet weather today.
Yeah, we've had a very wet winter, and we had a lovely spring day yesterday, but we're back to a bit of rain today. But it's, I think it is due to cheer up very soon and back to the spring.
Excellent.
And thank you, Terry. So can I just say thank you for the podcasts that you do? I think they bring the whole world together in sharing the stories of the battlefields, and please carry on, because it's the work that you do of talking to everybody and sharing that information is just so wonderful. Thank you.
We will continue to do it as long as people will talk to me and listen. David.
Absolutely. Sorry. Yes. I'll try and behave.
Thank you so much.
No, thank
You're
you.
You're very
Terry.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And as we said at the beginning of the podcast, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission commemorates the graves and memorials of 1.7 million servicemen and servicewomen throughout the Commonwealth. And it's in their memory, all of them, every single one of them, that we play The Last Post.